This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I decided this evening, instead of the usual Mitzvah Shabbos shir, to run through the Haggadah with you. And in fact, to open it to a bit of discussion, so that you can ask questions, you can make comments, and thereby all of you will be able to pick up some ideas to use during the Seder. And in going through, we'll touch on a few of the themes, some of which I've pointed out before, some of which we discuss at our Seder, and some of which are new. I've often wanted to, and in Emirat Hashem, next year I think I'm quite determined to arrange a communal Seder, so that we really have the opportunity of going through the Haggadah together. And if we can just remember to set the plans in motion early enough, we'll do it. But at least instead of that this year, I think if we've gone through it, or at least part of it, it will give us some kind of material to work on. There are a number of interesting aspects to the Seder that need to be appreciated. The first one is the concept of the term Seder, which is fundamental to the whole theme of Yetzias Mitzrayim and of the Haggadah. Seder meaning order. The theme of Seder is expressed clearly in the Chazal that says Al Tikro Chorus Elo Chirus, that the word used for the engraving of the words of the Ten Commandments onto the tablets of stone is Chorus. Chorus means engraved. The Chazal say don't read it Chorus, read it Chirus, which means free. There seems to be therefore a correlation between the freedom and the engraving, which really seem to be opposite concepts. Engraving is something which can never be wiped out. Engraving is something which can never be erased. And freedom is something which one sees freedom as something which easy come, easy go, and so on. But it's not so. The Torah's concept of Chayrus, which is the essential theme of Pesach, that freedom is tied closely to the concept of Chorus, of engraved, of permanence, of an indelibility, if there is such a word, of the impressions of Torah on the mind and on the conscience of the human being. So that Chayrus is found in Chorus. Chayrus is not found by an escape from Chorus. Chayrus is not found, freedom is not found by the escape from commitment. Freedom is found in commitment. And that's a very difficult concept. So Isaiah Berlin, I think, expressed it quite well in saying that, in talking about the difference between freedom from and freedom to. To be free from something, that's hefkerus, that's like tino kabureach mebeis hasefer that we once spoke about before, like the way a little child runs away from school and he's free, but he's not really free. Freedom is freedom to come to school. In school one's free, not out of school. It's through the gaining of education that one achieves freedom, but that's difficult for the little child to appreciate. So the immature person sees the commitment of seder, of system and of discipline, as an opposite to the principle of chayrus, and a mature person realizes that the only way he can achieve chayrus is through the commitment. He has a choice as to what he wants to commit himself to. But a person who is uncommitted to anything is not free at all. A person who is uncommitted to anything, in fact, is the biggest slave of all, because then he becomes a slave to his impulses. Then he has no way of directing himself, no way of moving himself from where he is to where he wants to go. The method of doing so is through the devising of a seder, of a system, step by step, in order to get there, and a choice to become totally committed to that seder which one has devised for oneself. And that's really what the seder is. And therefore we talk about the seder. Why do we call it the seder? Because it's mesudah. The whole thing is organized from point A to point Z, every step of the way, exactly what happens at what time, how it's to be done. And it's strange on the surface that we should be celebrating Chayrus with Seder, but once one understands the unity of those two principles expressed with Chorus and Chayrus, that freedom is found in the Seder, in the order and the commitment of engraving, one begins to see the theme emerging. And so you'll find your Haggadah start with an agenda, laying out what the Seder is going to be. So the principle that there's going to be a Seder is laid out very clearly in the beginning. Kadesh, Karpus, Magid, Moitzi, and so on. The whole system is laid out before we even start. And the Seder starts with Kiddush, which is also strange. Normally we're makpid that Kiddush should be before the Seuda, that there should be no hefsek, there should be no interruption between Kiddush and the meal. And the meal, we know, is going to come considerably later on. So really the place for the Seder should have been, the place for Kiddush should have been right before the meal, when we have our second glass of wine. So we should have two glasses of wine there. Say Kiddush on the first glass, and then say at the beginning of Hallel on the second glass, and then go straight into the meal. To say Kiddush right at the beginning and then have the Seder is a strange place for it, and for Kiddush to be the first item on the agenda of the Seder. It's not just part of the Yom Tov meal. We say Kiddush every Friday night, we say Kiddush every Yom Tov, but this Kiddush is different. This Kiddush forms part of the Seder, part of the Haggadah, part of the Seder as such. Why? Because one of the things that we say in Kiddush, in all our Kiddushim, is the theme, Zeicher Litzias Mitzrayim. Every time we say Kiddush, we mention that we have to remember the Yitzias Mitzrayim. So we start the Seder off with a mitzvah that we perform frequently, but it's a mitzvah that as frequently as we perform it, it is nevertheless related to the Yetzias Mitzrayim theme, and we choose that mitzvah to start off with Kiddush. Showing that even Kiddush, which we perform right through the year, has as its roots the principle of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And we then move into Karpas, which is the taking of the, or the chatz first before Karpas, the washing. The reason we wash is because any vegetable dipped in water, one needs to wash one's hands for before one eats, or one needs to dry the vegetable. The karpas is going to be dipped, and therefore we wash our hands before we have the karpas. And we say the borei pri ha'adam, we say a brocha, and the purpose of that brocha we have to have in mind is not only for the parsley or potato, whatever you use for the karpas which you're about to eat, but to also have in mind that you're going to, that brocha is going to be used for the moror, which you're going to have much later. What is the purpose of the karpas? Among other things, the purpose is to stimulate the children to ask questions. And that brings us to another theme of the Seder. The Seder is a structured order. As a structured order, one's entitled to say what is its purpose, what is it structured to achieve. If it was just that we sat down and had a shmooze, then it doesn't have to be structured to achieve anything, we have a shmooze together. But if it's structured with a certain design, then the designer must have had certain intentions. And one of the intentions are clearly to stimulate children to ask questions. And we see that all the way through in the Gemara. It's mentioned many times, we've got to do things to keep the children awake, we've got to do things to keep the children active. Why the children, and why do we stimulate the questions? If they ask, they ask. Why do we do funny things to get them to ask questions? We do even weirder things later on when we move the Seder plate backwards and forwards on the table and off the table, cover it, uncover it. It's all just to create a mysterious environment to get the children to ask questions. Why are we doing that? So that brings us to yet another theme. I'm just going to raise themes and you can explore them at your Seder table. The next theme is the theme of Haggadah. Haggadah means you tell. Telling. Now telling means that you've got to have somebody to tell it to. And you will find with children that if you tell them things they're not interested in hearing, they don't hear it. One of the preconditions for Haggadah, one of the preconditions to effectively communicate to a person, is to create in that person, firstly, a desire to be communicated to. He must want to hear. If he wants to hear, then you can be mekayim the mitzvah of Haggadah. So we've got to turn the child on. And we turn the child on not with intellectual means, which is also interesting. It's an interesting educational method. We're turning the child's interest and curiosity on with acts, with physical things, with emotional things, not with intellectual things. And we see here, I mean, this is the Haggadah, one can take the Haggadah on so many different levels. One could easily take the Haggadah as a perfect model of a Torah educational system. Because when we talk about what is this designed to do, it's designed to educate. That's primarily what we do on Pesach night, to educate ourselves and the participants and the children. So we can see here in this little package exactly how the Torah likes our educational system to operate. And the way we stimulate the child's interest is by doing all sorts of funny things, not by saying all sorts of things. Where does one find that in a school today? Where do you find the teacher in the class getting the child's interest going by things that they do. You'll sometimes find it in science classes, where a teacher who understands the role of experiments and the syllabus will actually get the children's interest through doing these experiments and showing the children all these sorts of interesting things, and then doing the theory that explains what they've seen in practice. That's the way it will operate. And that's the way it's done only in science, but it shouldn't be done only in science. It should be done in every single subject. It's by the creation of dramatic effect that curiosity can be stimulated. You've actually got to create an atmosphere that makes the child say, what's going on here? What's happening? And that we start doing already with the karpos, which leads us into magid, which is we first yachatz, we split the matzah, that's also part of the whole hocus pocus to make the to create the environment. Yes, we're splitting the middle matzah because of lechem oni, that it's the bread of poverty, and a poor person breaks his bread into two pieces to eat some later, and it's for the afikoman. There are all sorts of practical reasons that we're doing it as well. But why do we do it at this point? We're doing it at this point to create this atmosphere of doing strange things. And I always mention at my seder that the most tragic thing to me is that we do these strange things and nobody asks why. Which shows the level of natural curiosity. What's happened? The Torah designs a system of doing weird things that doesn't work anymore. We don't even find weird things weird anymore. There's nothing to ask. Nobody asks. That's not what gets people asking. Nobody asks these questions. Certainly not the children. And I believe that if one today were to, it doesn't have to be your Seder, it can be at your Friday night table, if you put on a black cloak and you had green smoke puffing through the room and all sorts of weird sounds coming through a loudspeaker system, and you chanted and you said all sorts of things and you walked around the table three times this way and three times that way, and then you sat down and said Amitzu with Kavona, and you had some newly converted religious people there, I don't think they would ask you what's going on. I mean, I'll take it, that's Yiddishkeit. That's they're used to seeing weird things and accepting weird things as normal. And they've been taught to expect things to be weird, and they've been taught to expect things not to be understood. When we had the young people at my house last Friday night, and I made reference to a particular book, and I asked one of the young ladies there, I asked the people there, whether they thought that that particular book, this is a very popular book used all over the place, a Torah book in English, whether they thought that was a good book. And this particular person said, yes, if you divorce your intellect from it, it's fine. And I asked her afterwards if she realized how clever what she said was. And she said, no, she didn't realize at the time. She realized that as the discussion developed, it was a very clever statement. That we've come to accept that if you divorce your intellect from Torah, then it's fine. Then it's okay. Then you can accept it. If you start asking too many questions, it doesn't make sense. So we're actually going through a process of seeking mystery and mystique in Torah instead of seeking reason and rationale. And that's why we don't ask questions. We break the matzah in two, and we dip, and we lean, and we do all sorts of funny things, and we accept that's the ritual. That's what we do. Anything that looks incongruous should be questioned. And there is an assumption in the Haggadah that a well-raised child, a well-educated child, will question the incongruous. So we're safe. If we do a few incongruous things, we'll get the questions, but we don't. What does the child do? He waits for his turn for Manishtana, and he opens the Haggadah on the right page, and then he reads the four prescribed questions. Yetzigven is his chiv to ask questions, and now he can get on with the Seder. It's just all so weird. That's not what it's meant to be. The four questions, the Manishtana, is merely an attempt to get the ball rolling, to define the type of questions that need to be asked, how they need to be asked, and they're not meant to be a substitute for natural curiosity. Then we start with Magid. And this brings us into another interesting theme, because we say in the beginning of Magid, before the Manishtana even, we say, HaLachmo An Yudi Achalu Avasono Ba'aruz Mitzrayim. This is the bread of poverty which our forefathers ate in Mitzrayim. The point of the matzah. This matzah is the bread of poverty which our forefathers ate in Mitzrayim. But later on in the Haggadah, let's see if we can find it quickly. Right before the meal, you'll remember it was Rabban Gamliel, I think, who said that anybody who didn't say these three things, lo yotso yodei chovos, hasn't fulfilled his obligation. What are the three things that everybody has to say? Pesach, Matzah, and Morah. When it comes to Matzah, he says, Matzah zu shonu echlim al shumah, why do we eat this Matzah? And he answers, Al shum shelo hispik betzeikom shelav yisheinu la'achamitz ad shenigla alei melech malchei amlochim ha'kodosh baruch hu ge'olam. The reason we have matzah is because when the Jews were fleeing from Egypt, they didn't have time for the bread to rise, And the Rebbein Shlom appeared suddenly, and they had to get on moving, and they had to take the bread out of the oven, and it wasn't ready, it hadn't risen yet, it was matzah. So we have two conflicting reasons in the Haggadah as to why we have matzah. In the Holach Ma'ani we say this is the bread they used to eat when they were in Mitzrayim, this is the bread of poverty. And Rabban Gamliel says the reason we eat matzah is to remember the Geula, the coming out, this is the bread of happiness. It didn't get a chance to rise, not because they were so busy with their shibud, with their working and their toil, that they didn't get a chance to let it rise. They were in a hurry to get out. The El Al plane was waiting and they had to move it. What is it? What is the reason for having matzah? Is matzah in memory of the shibud in Mitzrayim, of the slavery, or is the matzah in memory of the sudden exit from Mitzrayim, the release? And before I answer that, I want to get into the Manishtana, because that really is the question of the Manishtana. Now you'll see what kind of question we expect our children to ask. The question is, why is this night different from all other nights? And the Manishtana then records four differences, identifies four differences between this night and all other nights. The one is that we only eat matzah tonight, whereas other nights we eat what we want. The second is we only eat moror, whereas other nights we eat what we want. The third is we don't normally dip, tonight we dip twice. And the fourth is normally we eat however we want to, sitting up straight, reclining, and tonight we're reclining. We've often made the point that there are not four answers to these four questions, there's only one answer to that, and that's Avodim Ayinu L'Farid in Mitzrayim. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt and Hashem took us out. How does that answer the questions? Where are the four? There are four questions, there should be four answers. And we've often pointed out that this is one question. The question is, why is this night different from all other nights? And the differences are then specified, the four differences are contrasts. Two of the differences indicate slavery, and two of the differences indicate freedom. On the one hand, we eat matzah as opposed to chometz, which is slavery, and we eat moror as opposed to normal vegetables, which indicates slavery. On the other hand, we lean instead of sitting upright, which indicates luxury, and we dip instead of eating bland products, which indicates luxury as well. So we're doing two things which indicate luxury, two things which indicate slavery. Ask the child, what's going on? This is incongruous. That's the key word. What is going on? So we have, and what does the child pick on? Nothing we've said. The child picks on what we're doing. We see the system of education working perfectly. We're acting out incongruously in order to arouse the curiosity of the child. The child has noticed the incongruity, has pinpointed the incongruity, seen two examples of each, and asks, what is tonight? Are we remembering our slavery? Is this a kind of a Tisha B'Av? Are we remembering the Geula? Is this a Yom Tov? If it's a Yom Tov, why Moror? Why Matzah? And if it's a Tisha B'Av, why are we dipping and why are we reclining? What is the atmosphere of today? He picks up strange themes. And right through the Haggadah, it's necessary to notice the conflicting themes that go right through. And really, that's the point that I want to make this evening and that you can develop during your Siddurim, is why the conflicting theme, what is the role of the conflicting theme, and why must it be retained all the way through? There are two phases to the most pleasurable experiences that human beings have. The most pleasurable experience involves the sudden release from great tension. Whether it's in laughter, whether it's in entertainment, whether it's in the sexual experience, in all areas of great physical pleasure, and not only physical pleasure, there is from the earliest age of a child all the way through life, the greatest pleasures are experienced in the sudden release from intense tension. When people dwell on the tension without balancing that with the release, they become neurotic, they become funny people. And when they dwell on the release without the tension, they become ineffective people. There are people who just like the relaxed, they're laid back, I think is the term they use, and they're just like the no pressures, no anxieties, things should just be nice and calm and easy. They land up making a mess of their lives, thinking they're enjoying it, but as life goes on, realizing that they're not, because they've done nothing with it. The people who dwell on the tensions become neurotic. The key to maintaining a balanced life in this particular area is the movement from tension to relaxation and back again, the backwards and forwards. And one finds this in any work of art. If you read a good novel or you listen to a good piece of music, you will find that what keeps your attention is the build-up of tension and the resolution of the tension. And not a full resolution and then a build-up again and then again a little resolution and then a full build-up and then a massive resolution and then a slow build-up again. It has to be that way in order to keep the emotions involved. One cannot maintain an emotion on a bland level. You can't have a constant emotion. Emotions die when they're constant. Emotions need extremes in order to keep them going. They need to oscillate between two poles in order to be going. We need our highs and we need our lows. We need to go up and down. Of course, if we have no control over them and they dominate us, then we're in trouble. But if one has some kind of control and one finds oneself moving between these two extremes, in that one finds the tensions of life and the resolutions of those tensions. In that one finds the pleasures. In that one finds the joys. In that one finds the progress of life, the growth of life, as one copes with the tension and the resolution of tension. And we're given mechanisms in life and in Torah to build the tensions and to resolve the tensions. That is, in my mind, one of the very fundamental elements in the laws of family purity. The recognition that a husband and wife's physical relationship cannot be constant. There has to be a coming together and a moving apart, as I've mentioned in a previous year, in order to develop into that relationship also the tensions and the resolutions of tensions that are needed in order to keep the constancy. Ge'ula is the release of a tension. Shibud is the build-up of the tension. The one without the other is sick. If we would only see the enslavement and we would dominate ourselves with that experience and that emotion without emphasizing at least as much the geula, we would become neurotic. And if we only celebrated the geula, if we only celebrated the redemption and the freedom and the nationalism, going to Eretz Yisrael, without an appreciation of the tensions that preceded that, then we would lack the tensions altogether. There would be no progress, there would be no achievement. And if we watch these conflicting themes through the Seder, what we're watching is not only the build-up of tension followed by the release, but what we're watching is the retention of that sense of tension even at the time of release, in a sense. Because it's not a thing that there was once tension and then there was a geula, there was one shibud and then there was a geula, and that all happened many thousands of years ago and it's all over. Not that at all. We've actually built in mechanisms to be able to relive the tensions so that we can re-experience the geula, that we can re-experience the releases. And matzah is one of those things. What is matzah? Matzah is the thread that goes right through the theme from the beginning to the end. Matzah on the one hand is what they used to eat when they were slaves, and it's the same matzah that they used to eat at the time of the geula. That's the binding factor. The matzah is that which is constant in their tension lives, or in the tension phase of their lives, and in the freedom phase of their lives. The matzah didn't change. They had to have matzah even at the point of release of tension. Which in itself is important to realize that the chayrus didn't give them more leisure time. It didn't give them more freedom. It didn't give them... They still had to have matzah. Why? They were still in a hurry. What's the only difference? The difference is earlier they were in a hurry because the police were standing there with shamboks, and if they didn't get on with it, they got whipped. And now they're in a hurry because if they don't get on with it, they'll miss the train. There's the geula, the Ribbono Shel Olam is waiting for them. So come what may, they're in a hurry. The tension has not been resolved. They haven't lost the sense of tension because there's a geula. All that's happened is that one tension is now being released to be replaced by another tension. The tension of Paro is now being replaced by the tension of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the transition is one from one phase of tension to another phase of tension. The transition is not one from tension to freedom, and that's the end of the story. Because if it was that, that would have been the end of the story. There would have been no future for the Jewish people. But there needs to be the understanding that doesn't change. That's something that the new South Africans are going to have to learn in the next decade or two. That the release from the tensions of apartheid are not going to give them liberty in the sense that they understand liberty. It's not going to give them prosperity and wonderful things and white man's houses, and all that isn't going to happen. They're going to have to work just as hard as they worked before, perhaps even harder. anything. It's a different kind of thing. You're working for yourself instead of working for a system. There are merits in it. But what you thought during the time of tension, you worked for what? For the removal of that tension. When the removal of that tension comes, you've got to realize all that's happened is it's being replaced by a bigger tension. That's what it is, and that's how we grow, and that's how we develop, by that resolution. When they were involved in the Shibud, when they were totally immersed in their slavery, what did they dream about? What did they want? To get out, to get away, to be free, to have time. That never happened. They never became free, they never got time, they never got out. All they did was they moved into a different type of slavery, from Shibud to Paro, to Shibud to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's back to that theme of Seder and freedom, to Chayrus and Chorus. Your choice is what you want to be enslaved to. Your choice is not whether to be enslaved or not. Anybody who's going to live a life of achievement is going to be enslaved to certain visions, and is going to work like crazy to get to those visions. And that's going to make life hard and challenging for him. His choice is simply which vision he wants, what route he wants to take, what he wants to feel committed to. But his choice is not to opt out. There isn't an opting out. And that's the famous Chazal with Yaakov, when he was Bikesh Lasheves Bishalva, when Yaakov wanted to sit in peace, Kopsolem Orogzosh, Yosef, then the whole story of Yosef unfolded. There is no such thing as a tzaddik saying, I'm retiring, my work is over, I've done my bit, now I want to take it easy. There's no such thing as taking it easy. That's not freedom. Freedom is simply choosing where you want to exert your energies, but not to take it easy. And that you'll find is a theme that goes right through. So when the child asks, Manishana Laila Zemi Kolalilus, what's happening tonight? Is this freedom or is this bondage? What are we celebrating? The answer is both. Avodim Ayinu Lefala B'Mitzrayim, we were slaves, by Yetzienu Hashem Elokeinu, and Hashem took us out. We're not celebrating one or the other. We're not here to commemorate the slavery, nor are we here to commemorate the Gula. We're here to commemorate that moment, which was the release from the slavery into the Gula. And to celebrate that moment, you need both. You need an appreciation of the slavery, and you need an appreciation of the Gula. You have to be able to relive the slavery and relive the Gula, and it is the intense contrast of the two that enables you to value the Gula. Because what happens if you don't have that? If you start with the Gula, let's say that the history of the Jewish people would have started with their leaving Mitzrayim. At that moment the history would have started, and that's where our national consciousness would have started, when we leave Mitzrayim. And what would have happened from there, what was the first thing that happened, is Matan Torah. So that would be our slavery. We would see that as slavery. The only reason we see Torah as freedom is because we see Mitzrayim as slavery. If you've been in Mitzrayim, then you understand that Torah is freedom. If you've never been in Mitzrayim, then to you Torah is just a bond. Torah is a burden. It's only when there is that contrast that one can realize, I have been freed from that tension, and the tension I have been given is a creative tension and a joyful tension. It's a different tension altogether. And so the theme then develops, going right back to what we were via the four sons. Why is there emphasis, by the way, on the four sons? The Haggadah takes a lot of time on that, and there's a lot of depth in those four sons, as in the Manishtana. Why so much emphasis on these questions and the four sons' questions, the differences between the question? Because what is a question? A question is, in the intellectual pursuit, exactly what we've been talking about in the emotional pursuit. Questions are what create tensions. If a person listens to a shiur and he's got no kashas, he's got no questions before, during or after, it's no fun for him, and it's no fun for the person giving the shiur. There's no tension. The whole process of learning is a process of building up the tension, and the tension is built up through the formulation of questions. And questions don't mean I don't understand. That's not a question. That's an admission of lack of intelligence or lack of preparedness. That's all it is. Don't understand. Don't know what's going on. That's not a question. A question has to be formulated. You said A, therefore B. If B, therefore C. If C, how can it be D? A question has to be formulated and worked out, where you're able to build up to a point where there's a tension, and the question creates that tension. And that, in the giving of a shir, is important as well. One can't just recite a shir. In the giving of a shir also, one has to build it to a point where the audience, where the participants realize that you're building to a point where there are issues that are unresolved. That creates a tension. Then when there is the resolution of that tension, one has an emotional involvement in the subject matter. And so the Haggadah introduces us to the different types of questions that are asked. The question of the Chochom, the question of the Rosho, the question of the Tam and the Shein and the Elishol, how one handles that and how one works with them. It's interesting to note that we treat the She'ena De'alisha rather harshly, the one who doesn't know how to ask any questions. We basically say to him, we use the same phrase that we use to the Rosha. The Haggadah says, well, the fisher it sees that's women haklo. Since the Rosha excludes himself, the wicked man excludes himself from the community, kofar ba'ika, he has denied essential principles, and you also be very sharp with him and say, ba'avuze asa Hashem li b'tzeisim b'mitzrayim, Hashem did this for me when I came out of Egypt, excluding him. When it comes to the Shemir De'elishul, we do the same thing. Be'igadato levincho ba'yom ahu, you shall tell your child that day, say, ba'avuze asa Hashem li b'tzeisim b'mitzrayim, Hashem did this for me when I came out of Egypt. Hashem did this for me when I came out of Egypt? What about poor him? That's the question, that's the answer we use to the Rosh to exclude him. If you were there, you wouldn't have been part of it. And that's the same thing we're telling the Shehende De'elisha. The Shehende De'elisha, a person who doesn't ask questions, is usually a person who doesn't care enough to ask a question. That doesn't mean he doesn't know how to ask a question. It's just not important enough for him to formulate a question, to find anything curious or strange. And we've got to get him out of that mode, because that's really a self-centered mode. He's so self-involved that objects outside of him don't pose as curious. Curiosity is a sign of a creative mind. It's a sign of a mind that is involved in things outside of itself. Lack of curiosity is a sign of a mind that is involved within itself. So when we talk about gaiva, when we talk about arrogant people and people who are not curious, normally we see them as opposites. The arrogant person is the one who asks why, always asking questions, always challenging, isn't he arrogant? A nice little Nebuchadnezzar who goes around, never questions anything, never asks. He's a nice fellow. It's not so at all. It's in fact the other way around. The person who's always asking is not involved in himself. He's concentrating on things outside himself, and he's puzzled by them. He finds them curious. The person who never finds anything outside of himself curious and isn't struck by the incongruities of life is a person who's so involved in himself that it doesn't bother him what's happening anywhere else. So we've got to try and get him out of that. We want him to ask questions. And what questions do we want him to ask? Right through we see the type of questions we're seeking are the why questions, not the how questions. We want people to ask why. Why is this? Why did Hashem do this? Why are you doing this? What is the purpose? We want value questions, and that's why we do these odd things. We don't want the child to ask what are you doing. You can see what we're doing. We don't want the child to ask how do you do it. That's not the Pesach kind of question. The Pesach kind of question is why. Why is this night different from all other nights? What's happening? What's behind it? What is the underlying principle? What is under it? And that's how we learn Gemara also. On one level, how? We need to know how the sugya fits together. That's the technical side. But when that's all done, then the learning starts with the why questions. Why is it this way? How do you get a She'eni Yodea Lishol to ask why? How do you get a person who has no natural curiosity, who's never asked a question in his life, how do you get him to ask why? There's only one way to do it, and that's to hurt him. You give him a prick, and what's he going to say? Why did you do that? Fine. Shkeach, the first why question you've ever asked. That's what I wanted to hear from you. Why did you do it? Let's sit and talk. But he's out of himself already. At that point he's out, and that's what we intend to do here. Bavuze asa Hashem li b'tzeisi b'mitzrayim. What's he going to say? Who do you think you are? Why you? And if I was there, why are you excluding me? Why? Oh, I'll tell you why, because you've never asked a question. Now that you've asked the question, you're not excluded, and you've got him talking already. That's the way we deal with the She'eni De'elisha. In fact, the person who gets the worst treatment out of all the four, I think, is the Tam. The She'eni De'elisha gets treated harshly, but it arouses a response. The Rosha we treat intelligently, harshly but intelligently. The Chacham, of course, we treat intelligently. The Tam gets a rough deal. He says, Mazos, what's going on? Well, Ma Tayel, so tell him the story. Hashem took me out with a strong hand, took us out with a strong hand from the house of God. Tell him the Ma'aseh, tell him the story. That's it. Because he doesn't ask a why question. The Tam asks Ma'aseh, what's going on? What's going on here? That's all he will say. What's happening? He's not to the point of even asking why, and it's not because he's not involved. That's where he's holding. So you tell him the story. By telling him the story, you will involve him in the story at least, and he will become involved that way. So the Chacham becomes involved with his intellect. The Rosho becomes involved with his value system and with the challenge. The She'eni De'elisha becomes involved by his own ego. He gets hurt and he asks why. And the Tam becomes involved with the story. You tell him stories, tell him Maisavach, that will involve him. And then the story starts. and we start working out mitchilo evde avodah zorah yu avisenu, in understanding the contrast created by the geula, we have to go back to the origins of our history, and the origins of our history start long before the time of Avraham Avinu even, when we've got to realize who we were, what idol worshippers we came from, what a real degenerate background we came from. Then we can appreciate who we are and where we're holding. And that too is terribly important. A visiting rabbi here gave a shiur in the Beis Hamidrash and said to me afterwards that he didn't realize when he prepared the shiur the first time, he prepared it what he thought was a difficult shiur, and he didn't realize the standard. So I said to him, well, you should tell the people that. It's nice for them to get that chizuk, because they don't realize. They carry on learning year after year. They don't feel the progress. It's not like a school or a university where you go from first year to second year to third year. You feel you've got, you get your doctorate, you feel you've got somewhere. People in this place in Medrash have been learning for years and years, and they're still in the same shiur, so they don't feel the progress. So you should tell them that. The important thing in measuring one's own progress is constantly to look where you've come from. Not only to look forward. One has to look forward as well, I suppose. One has to have a vision as to where one's going. But it's much more important to look where one's coming from. That's why they say, Lev Chochom B'yaminay, Lev Ksul B'svoyla, I think the Pasuk is. A Chochom's heart is on the right hand side, and a stupid person's heart is on the left hand side. And if you look at a Sefer, if your heart is on the right hand side, that's the material you've covered already. The left hand side is the material you've still got to cover. So a clever person's heart is on what he's done already. He concentrates on how far he's come, and he realizes, where was I holding 2 years ago? Where was I holding 3 years ago? Where was I holding 5 years ago? Where was I holding 10 years ago? Look at me, look where I've come. Whereas the foolish person looks only at the future and doesn't find the pleasure of the past. It's that same thing. You cannot experience the joy of the release of tension if you haven't identified the tension, and the tension lies in the past. The tension lies in looking where you were, and the release of tension is looking where you are. And it's all very well, now you can go to a bookshelf and you can take out a sefer and you can work out a rishon or an achron. That's very nice, that's very fine, but you don't enjoy that unless you stop for a moment and say to yourself, do I realize what I'm doing? I've opened a rashbo and I've sat and I've learnt it 3 years ago, 5 years ago. What could I do? Then one understands where that's coming from. And we see in the Haggadah right through an attempt to go right back and understand where you come from, not just where you came from in Egypt before the Geula, but how you got to Egypt, and long before that, before Yaakov, before Yitzchak, before Avraham, go right back to the origins. Then you'll appreciate the enormity of the Geula, and without that it's not possible to appreciate the enormity of the Geula. Then the 10 plagues fit into the release of tension area, having built up, and that's what you have to try and do in your Seder. Not just to read through the Haggadah blandly, but to actually try and dramatically build up the pressure so that the point of the tension, so that by the time you come to the 10 plagues, you're actually in the atmosphere of that release of pressure, to realize what in fact is taking place. And that eventually breaks out into the Hallel, which is the praise of Hashem for that release of tension. And the meal, which really forms part of the Hallel, the meal finds itself in a very strange position. The meal finds itself in the middle of Hallel. We start Hallel, and in the middle of Hallel we have the meal, because the meal itself is both a celebration of the release from tension, a celebration of the Geula, and also forms part of the Hallel itself. The meal is what is going to enable us to make a Birkas HaMazon, to make a benching. As we discussed earlier in the Shabbos HaGodol Shir, we don't bench because we've eaten. We eat in order to be able to bench. And that benching has a special meaning on Pesach. Since we've understood the whole thing, we've gone through this whole process now of pressure, of poverty, of affliction, and the release from this pressure. And now we can sit free people, and we can have a suudo, and we can lean back, and we can eat and enjoy ourselves, and appreciate all the consequences of that geula. That leads us into a birkas hamazon, into a benching, such as one doesn't ordinarily have. And it's unfortunate that many of us Sidorim, we tend to regard the benching as very routine. The Haggadah is the exciting part. The benching we do every day, there's nothing special about the benching. There's something very special about the Seder benching. The Seder benching, which forms also part of the Seder, it has its own niche in the agenda, is a different benching to any other benching during the year. The way one is able to bench after the Pesach meal, if it's come after the correct build-up, is a completely different benching to the benching that one has during the rest of the year. And then we go into the conclusion of the Hallel. and finally into the conclusion of the Haggadah itself. I have promised myself that 1 year we'll do a thorough study of I don't know about Echad Miyodea, but of Chad Gad Yo, certainly of the principles of it and the beauty of that poetry and the depth of concepts that are contained in it. All I've tried to do is to briefly scan through the Haggadah from the beginning right the way through, to pick out a couple of themes that you should develop yourselves during your Siddurim, to try and find them expressed in the different parts of the Haggadah, and to develop them as you go through the Haggadah. There are a couple of minutes if anybody wants to ask anything or to contribute anything. Let's just say yes, Ro. It's not punishment, and it's not negative reinforcement, it's challenge. And it's unfortunate that our whole educational system and the psychological system is geared around entertainment rather than challenge. There are two ways to involve a person: entertain him and he'll be involved, provide a show for him and he'll be involved, or challenge him. And there are different types of people. There are the type of people who will not respond to challenge, so they need entertainment. And there are the type of people who don't, few of them, who don't respond that well to entertainment, who respond better to challenge. One thing is for sure is that the response to challenge is a much deeper response. And that's why we've always commented that after Yetzias Mitzrayim, when they go to Har Sinai and there's all that drama and all those nisim and all those wonders, and then followed by the Egel Azov, they fall to the golden calf after minutes after the most incredible exposure. But that wasn't challenge, that was entertainment. There was no one-to-one challenge yet. The challenge came later when Moshe came down with the Torah and started teaching them the Torah. Then there was challenge and they built themselves up consistently. But with the drama, they were able to be raised to the highest levels, and it was gone a little while later. There was nothing left at all. And that is part of the problem of modern psychology and education, that we're so scared of offending the person. We're so scared of hurting him. We've come to confuse hurt and damage. We think hurting people damages them. Hurting people doesn't damage them. It can, if it's done insensitively, it can damage them. But it's not necessarily so. There's a difference between hurt and damage. Hurt is part of an educational process. Pain and suffering is part of a development. And it doesn't necessarily involve damage. And there has to be hurt in a classroom. And there has to be hurt between a parent and a child. And there has to be hurt in one another in a chavrusa sometimes. That's what creates the tension and the challenge. There's nothing wrong with it, as long as it's done with sensitivity. And as long as the build-up takes place afterwards, one doesn't leave it with a hit. But you're right, you've pinpointed what a tangent that secular education has taken. And it's of concern to me, as we've discussed often, even in these shiurim, that we're tending to do the same in Torah. We've suddenly realized if you entertain people, the crowds come. So let's entertain them. It's not Torah. It's true that crowds come. And it's true they can pick something up through that entertainment. But that's not the end of the story, that's just the beginning. Entertainment is not a substitute for challenge in education. Which are two different forms of tension. But isn't that in itself a release? In other words, what I'm saying is, to release from tension, do you need total release? Or is it, if that tension is removed, even though it's substituted by a new tension, does that not also constitute tension release?
The word release
is misleading.
If you listen to music, there's a change in mood. Yeah, that's not so much release, it's a change in mood that's
I'm not sure. I think we need to do a bit of thinking on that. I'm not sure that that's altogether right. It's possible that if the shibud to Paro is totally removed, that in itself constitutes a release of tension, with all the things that go with the release of tension, except Hefkerus. One thing that it doesn't do is Hefkerus. In other words, if you took, for example, a student who'd been in university going through a difficult course for years and years, a doctor, whatever, and the day he finishes his exams, as he walks out of the exam room, he's given his results and walks into his practice, or into the ward as the consultant. And there's no time to even go and have a drink. On the one hand, you'll say there's no time for release of tension, but there is a moment that is all gone. The exams are over, student days are over, finished. I'm into a new world, and there is some kind of release. It's not release in the normal sense of the world, where there's a sense of efkeiros, of abandon. I can't abandon myself. I can abandon my old shibud, but that's merely to find through a kind of a metamorphosis that I'm into a new shibud. And I think we need to think exactly how it operates psychologically and humanly, what effect it has, and whether it can have the same relaxing effect on an individual as normal release of tension has.